This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We don't just call this just slacking off anymore. No, it's a sabbatical.
I'm going to, you know, learn about the world and myself, and it'll be a good time.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Sean Johnson of Education Policy, Janie Skull.
I'm out, Mike. I'm out.
You're out. Exactly. That's the point.
I know.
Janie is on her way out. The big event is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what big event in education. We're really finally getting to the big reform crescendo.
The summer crescendo of Fordham.
Yes.
And I'm out.
And Janie is bailing on us just like Sean Johnson, bailing just before the Olympics. Is it an injury that is causing you to leave, Janie? Do you have tendonitis? What is it?
No, it's just, it's fatigue. let's see.
You got nothing. Janie is off to graduate school. That is what is going on. Yeah. Going to UPenn.
Taking a sabbatical for the summer first.
But a sabbatical. I like that. It's not just, you know, we don't just call this just slacking off anymore. No, it's a sabbatical.
I'm going to, you know, learn about the world and myself, and it'll be a good time.
Janie, this is all joking aside, very sad for us here at Fordham. Janie's been a great part of our team for many years. But we are excited. She's going to go on to the University of Pennsylvania and get her PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, we are suddenly going to be populated by by PhDs around here.
I know.
Who knew?
Exciting.
I know. It's making me look less and less qualified every day. So, Janie, this is your last podcast. Mm-hmm. Though, hey, you're always welcome to come back.
Good to know.
Once you're a graduate student, you might even do maybe a guest research minute sometime.
That would be fun. Yeah? I would love to.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, we got lots to cover this week. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
This week, Arne Duncan upheld a $36 million fine on South Carolina for failing to maintain sufficient special education spending during the recession. Is he right to ding the state for neglecting its special needs students?
Well, first of all, I would question the way this is phrased here, Ty. Neglecting its special needs students. We really don't know that that's what's happening. Look, you know, these maintenance of effort policies have been on the books forever, and nobody pays much attention to them because they haven't been an issue for a long time. Education spending has gone up for many decades. Well, suddenly we hit the Great Recession, and some states and districts actually see spending go down, including for special ed, and suddenly states aren't able to maintain their effort. It means they're spending less on special ed than they were the year before. And it's nuts to penalize states for finding ways to stretch the school dollar. We don't know at all.
Unless they are doing it disproportionately, which I don't know in the South Carolina case. But if they're like cutting only funds from special education, not any from regular education, I don't think that would be okay.
Right. But that's not the, I mean, I don't know South Carolina's particulars, but the law isn't, it doesn't just say, hey, if you cut disproportionately, it says if you cut special ed at all, which actually means you have to, it mandates that you cut disproportionately the non-special ed dollars. This is totally nuts. I mean, these provisions are outdated. And Arne Duncan, who has himself talked about the need for the new normal, should be able to look at the situation and say, hey, this is nuts. This is ridiculous. I'm not going to enforce something that was written 30 years ago that didn't anticipate this kind of downturn, and I'm going to waive this provision. Why isn't he doing that?
I mean, I don't know. I think he's very concerned, you know, obviously with the SPED lobby and a lot of people who will argue that it's not fair to shortchange special needs students just because, you know, they have, I guess they consume more money these days, or new spending at least. So, you know, it's not fair to cut them and not cut regular students.
But they are cutting the regular kids.
I know. I just think at the end of the day, the conversation needs to obviously turn towards what's being effective. I mean, a lot of special ed kids are in general ed classrooms right now. I mean, who are we really taking money from? Mm-hmm. What are we really affecting when we cut special ed or when we cut general ed? Maybe there is a way to do it disproportionately that actually helps all students because some money's going to waste and some money isn't. It's just not a smart way to look at it to just say you can't cut money. Yeah, there's so many other more important ways to look at it.
And we know this comes on the heels of Arne Duncan's flip-flop on this issue
He's a flip-flopper.
Where he said that there was going to be a provision that if states spent less in 1 year that they get hit with this sort of maintenance of effort penalty, but then they wouldn't get hit again as long as they maintain that level.
Yeah.
Instead, now they have to go bump back up to their previous level. All this is to say, look, we know that there are districts that spend exorbitant amounts of money on special ed and don't get good results. Other districts that are much smarter about it and provide very good services to these kids, services that parents are happy about, and do it for much less. And if we want districts to stretch the school dollar around special ed and provide high quality services, the federal government is getting in the way.
You know what step one is, though? reporting special ed spending.
Amen.
There's such poor data on it, you don't even know what to do with this. So.
Amen, sister. Okay, topic number two.
As of this recording, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is favored to win a contentious recall election. What would a Walker victory mean for politicians looking to reform education spending?
So first of all, we should admit to our listeners, it's Tuesday, we're recording this. We were tempted to just pretend that he won or maybe tape two versions of this. Yeah, he wins,
choose
he
your
loses.
Adventure version.
There's a great piece today saying that all these people are saying that this election is so important and so vital and they're going to all change their minds at the end of Tuesday night if it doesn't go their way. And they're going to say, yeah, none of this matters at all, actually. This was just unique to Wisconsin. So we don't know the outcome. So Janie, does this matter? Do you think politicians are watching this in terms of their willingness to take on the unions around spending, around healthcare benefits, around collective bargaining?
I mean, I absolutely think they're looking towards it. It's someone who challenged a very powerful interest group and now is being very challenged back. I don't think it's going to encourage someone who's really looking to stay in a job or stay in a job to be able to do other things. I mean, if this is someone's main thrust, like, Adrian Fenney, who was like, I want to reform the schools and I don't care if I get ousted, they're probably still going to do it. But if they're fearing getting ousted, then they're actually not going to do it. I mean, I think at this point, yes, he is favored to win. It's probably not going to be a big deal. But I think even that will still, you know, if you can recall someone for any decision that they make that, you know, some segment of the public doesn't like, I think it's just going to make politicians a lot more hesitant to do anything bold.
Yeah, I mean, look, I buy the argument that this is pretty significant. If he wins, it shows a couple of things. First of all, now in this era of sort of unlimited political spending by these super PACs, you know, he was able to rally all these interests to his side and spend a crazy amount of money. Mm-hmm. This now, at least you can argue, balances the power that the unions have had for so long in raising money and getting messages out. This is also an opportunity here. I mean, you hear from some of these news reports in Wisconsin, these rank and file voters talking about, hey, it's unfair that teachers and other public employees have these privileged pension plans, that they have these, you know, these gold-plated health benefits. I mean, none of that is well known outside of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this has raised the profile of those issues. The unions are going to have to decide if they want to pick more fights like this in other states and have, you know, rich, you know, conservative donors spend money on TV ads telling people, hey, you know, your teachers have a real sweet deal and it's going to drive our schools bankrupt.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at states that allow collective bargaining and you look at what's in that collective bargaining law, Wisconsin now is the most restrictive, if not the second or third. I mean, it allows wages and that's about it. Mm-hmm. So there are tons of other states out there that if their governors or whoever decided they wanted to tackle this, there is room for tackling, certainly. And you're right. If you raise the public's awareness of it, it might get challenged earlier, but I just don't think that with this type of pushback, there's going to be a rush to do it.
Yeah, and look, this is largely about healthcare, okay? Mm-hmm. Not in the Obamacare kind of way, but in the fact that teachers and other public employees tend to have very generous healthcare plans. Those can be constrained, especially healthcare plans for retirees. Those are not protected by state constitutions like teacher pensions are. Mm-hmm. And so if you're saying, hey, there's a fiscal train wreck coming, that is one place you can go. And the unions, of course, know that. They're pushing very hard to keep those plans in place. You could say this balances the power. You got places like Milwaukee that are saving a lot of money now because they have the authority to say, hey, we cannot have these gold-plated healthcare plans as much. We're going to ask for more co-pays, or we're going to say you got to go in network, or all the other things that we're all used to hold down healthcare costs. Okay, Ty, topic number three.
A new Education Next survey found that only 22% of Americans think teacher unions have a positive effect on schools, while 37% view them negatively. Are the teacher unions in trouble, or are they immune to public opinion?
You know, and this has gone much more negative in just the last year, Janie. Is this a big deal?
I think it is. I mean, I think this is something that hasn't been seen before. It's unions have had this traditional dominance in so many states, and then for the first time, like in places like Wisconsin and Ohio and other places, they really are being challenged, and they're starting to lose those challenges for the first time. It's remarkable to look at how many policies that were once kind of in the favorable union camp have changed in the past 2 years that are now in the non-favorable union camp at the state level. I mean, that's remarkable, and I think a lot of it is, in a way, that's feeding the public perception that, you know, these debates are happening at the state level now. There are people saying that unions are bad, and I think not only is it leading to them losing these debates, it's then kind of snowballing, and it's you know, feeding the public opinion negatively.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we have to be careful here, because the unions in the past have shown their ability to have comebacks, and what they do is they make the case that, look, when you are hating on the unions, you're hating on teachers, and people, even though they don't like teacher unions, they still love teachers, rightfully so. And so you hear Randy Weingarten, when Mitt Romney comes out attacking teacher unions, very quickly saying, hey, he's attacking teachers. And that's not nice. And, you know, boo on you. And we've seen in the past that argument can get a hold of people. So I think this is going to be interesting to see. You know, I think Republicans and conservatives have found a line of attack when they talk generally about public sector employees as a privileged class, and teachers as a part of that. You notice that they don't have as much success if police and firemen are included. You know, but if you can paint that as, you know, the teachers are a part of this sort of bureaucratic class that's getting special perks, you know, there seems to be some resonance. But I don't know. I don't know that this is going to I have a feeling that some of this is going to bounce back.
Probably some of it will. You're right. But I think there are three things that are different about right now than in the past. One of them is that we have data to actually measure school, you know, efficacy, you know, school success and student success. And we can point to something like charter schools and say, look, they have a lot of success. Teacher unions don't like them. That's a problem. You know, we didn't have that in the past. I think the other thing is that Democrats have started turning against unions, which generally hasn't happened in the past. And then the third thing is just that, as the survey shows, teachers are starting to turn against unions. There's actual kind of dissension in the ranks. And if teacher unions aren't supported by their members, they're not going to be supported by the public either. So.
Okay. Well said, Janie. We are going to miss your insights. And I especially like it when you disagree with me. And when you come back, maybe you can do more of that.
Okay. I'll try.
All right. Well, now it is time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
It was nice to see you and your mom at a little party I threw over the weekend.
Wasn't that nice? Yes. She was in town and wanted to go, and she had a good time.
I heard that you live in a treehouse.
I do kind of live in a treehouse, yes. You know, we had a couple of activities, kind of team building, over the weekend for Fordham. There was a rowing event, Learn to Row. Daniela here on team coaches a local high school rowing team, crew team, and then a barbecue at my house. It was interesting that the sort of young people went rowing and the old people went to the barbecue. Amber, notice which side of that divide you're on.
I noticed that. That's sad.
Okay, so what you got for us this week?
Anyway, it was a little slim pickings, but there was a new report out on the CMOs by Serpia Mathematica. We've reported on these before. They're doing a series of reports on CMOs. This one focused on how CMOs manage talent. Data were gleaned from two separate surveys, one of CMO central staff and roughly 40 CMOs. They did a survey of CMO principals. They interviewed 150 leaders and teachers, so on and so forth, observed teachers in classrooms. All right, bottom line, three findings. First, CMOs recruit and hire for best fit. I think we knew this, but now, you know, there's a bunch of data that show it. They target particular sources of teachers, namely TFO. They recruit via TFA. Sorry, I'm so CMO, TFO, you get it. And recruit via messaging, which we kind of knew this too, but it's kind of interesting to see, you know, how it's spelled out in the report. So a lot of the messaging is, you know, this is really hard work, but we're doing it because we're on a mission to help kids learn. So it's kind of an inspiring message, but also realistic about how hard you're going to work. They feel like this helps them teachers self-select into their application process. Second finding, they actually have intensive and ongoing socialization on the job, which they define as basically insisting that teaching is a public endeavor. There's a sort of open door thing. You're going to be routinely observed. You're going to give each other real-time feedback. So it's sort of this cultural thing. And third, that CMOs align pay and career advancement opportunities with organizational goals. So often they found that exceptional teachers who were identified via a variety of measures were offered the opportunity to work as a coach, a mentor, or even to go to a new school when they were seeding new schools. They take their best teachers over there. Finally, the report concludes that despite labor contracts and other constraints, traditional districts can apply some of these lessons, including crafting their own recruitment messages, recruiting from alternative programs, and broadening their selection processes.
You know, it strikes me that yes, a lot of this we've known, but also that many urban districts have been doing this for a while, especially the ones that work with the New Teacher Project and have their various Teaching Fellows programs, that those ads you see for Teaching Fellows are very much about, hey, this is tough work. Are you up for it? You know, are you, you know, kind of like a Marines advertisement
right.
almost. You know?
Right.
Are you one of the chosen few who can handle this?
And that's just like TFA, too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The question I think that people ask, and I think it's right, is to say, you know, are we turning teaching into some kind of missionary job? And is that sustainable? And people are willing to be a missionary for a few years in their 20s, you know, before they have families. But again, if that works for these subset of charter schools that get great results, fantastic. But the scalability just is not going to be there because there's not enough 20-somethings willing to be missionaries.
That's right. And they did talk about burnout, teacher burnout, which we keep hearing. And what do we do about that? And
but it sounds like some of the stuff they're doing is trying to keep people in the job. You know, like you said, it's that kind of socialization, or it was aligning, you know, their mission to kind of the pay and benefits of their employees. So maybe if you can reel people in with the mission and then you kind of give them a great job, they'll stay.
Right. And give them a new opportunity. I mean, it's kind of fun to start a new school and be part of building that. I mean, you know, and you feel like, wow, I was chosen to go to this new school. So, yeah, I think they are using incentives, you know, obviously unique in a way that traditional schools can use. I thought one other little thing which I didn't talk about was one of the main ways they found that they recruit folks are through work simulations. So literally, and I thought about Fordham, we give our folks homework when we're, you know, trying to assess fit. So they have their applicants in teams, four or five, and they give them problems to solve, you know, that you would have like in your own, in a real situation, this teacher's struggling with, you know, this kid who can't do fractions or whatever, and they have applicants work through these work simulations and kind of observe them and see, you know, how they're problem solving. So
I mean, it seems to make sense. You want to make sure someone can actually do the job well, not that just that they can on paper.
And that is eminently doable by traditional public schools, right?
That's right.
I mean, Amber, when you think back to your days teaching, I mean, can you imagine the schools and the system that you were in doing any of this stuff?
No. I mean, and the other thing they found is that all it was demonstration lessons were across the board. Like you had to come in and do a demonstration lesson for the, you know, the central office.
Yeah.
I never had to do that. I mean, no, it was a paper application and an interview with the superintendent that lasted 10 minutes.
Why?
So,
do you think it's changed?
I don't think so.
I mean, so what is it? I mean, is it because, you know, you taught in
Virginia and North Carolina.
Virginia and North Carolina. These are non-union states. I mean, it's hard to make the case that this is because of some kind of policy barrier. I mean, it's just what? That the district's just, this is the way they've always done it?
Yeah, I just think they don't put enough energy in it. I don't know. I just think it's not where their priorities lie. It's and recruitment and hiring is not it. It's really not.
What's the priorities then?
Yeah, PD.
Okay.
Like they spend a lot of money on PD. Like how? Well, like
so
once
they'll
you
take
get,
anyone, but then
once
they'll
you
make
get
them good.
The subpar teachers, not that I was subpar, mind you, but once you get them in, like how do you make them better? Yeah, and this kind of turns it on its head. It's a lot more energy in terms of, you know, recruiting the right people, which is how it should be. Hello.
Wow. All right. Well, hey, we're hoping that there's some people out there listening from traditional public schools who might take some of these lessons to heart, as well as from other charter schools. I mean, this is a study of some of these high-performing CMOs. I love this kind of research. We're really trying to glean lessons.
Black box. Yeah,
like inside the black box. We've got something like this on school spending that we're working on, trying to look at those secrets from these fantastic schools that can be applied elsewhere. And a lot of these lessons can be applied. It's just trying to figure out why the heck other schools and traditional public school systems are not, you know, just can't wait to get this information and use it.
Right.
Maybe they need it in book form. I don't know. But
yes, a policy brief. Maybe.
Perhaps a policy
not
brief.
Not a 500-page report. Although, I have to say, they did actually do a policy brief of this report, which I thought was great.
Yeah,
there's the 500-page version and then the 4-page version.
All right.
Good,
let's get it out to the masses. All right. That is all the time we have for this week. Janie, we will miss you. Typically, we would say, till next week.
I will miss my loyal podcast listeners.
All right. Well, let's say it anyways.
Okay.
Till next week.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.